Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington. Ahead, our correspondent joins us to discuss all the changes in the race for the White House. The U.S. president has announced his nominee to be a Supreme Court justice. A young American has handed a difficult sentence in North Korea. And a new app to see what life was like in another time.
Suddenly, Trafalgar Square in London is not in 2016, but in 1940 during the Nazi Blitzkrieg.
It's right here on the Voice of America. Tuesday proved to be a big day in the race for the White House, with some front-runner wins, a runner-up getting his home state, and one candidate dropping out. Republican front-runner Donald Trump called it an amazing evening.
All over the world, they're talking about it. Millions of people are coming in to vote. We have a great opportunity, and the people that are voting are Democrats are coming in, independents are coming in, and very, very importantly, people that never voted before. It's an incredible thing.
However, Trump did not win in Ohio. That went to the state's governor, John Kasich. And after losing his home state of Florida, Marco Rubio walked away from the contest. On the Democratic side, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton took a huge step towards securing her party's nomination against her lone rival, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
Well, I'll tell you, this is another Super Tuesday for our campaign.
Senior National Affairs Correspondent Jim Malone joins us here in the studio to give us insight to all of this. Welcome, Jim, as always.
Hi, Susan.
You're getting to be a regular in the studio.
Yeah, you know, enjoy it.
Thank you. We enjoy having you. Well, what's the big picture here for the Republicans?
Okay, really good night for Donald Trump. Was it the best possible? No, because John Kasich was able to win in his home state of Ohio. What does that mean? Trump is still on a path toward the Republican nomination, but Kasich's win and the delegates that go with it by winning Ohio makes it a little more likely that Trump may fall just short of the number of delegates he needs to claim the nomination before we get to the party nominating convention in Cleveland in July. So there's some wiggle room. Who does that help? It helps the Republican establishment, who is still not sold on Donald Trump. So the anti-Trump forces believe there's still some hope there, even though it may be fading. It's a three-man race right now. Trump, Ted Cruz, and John Kasich. Trump by far has the easiest path, but it's not a sure thing quite yet.
And if he doesn't win that sure thing, if he doesn't win enough nominees when it gets there to the big meeting, they might just decide to go ahead and vote separately.
Well, here's the risk with that, though. And Trump has already been talking about this. He says his followers might be very, very upset if they try to take the nomination away from him at the convention. And I think you're going to hear more of that talk. So as much as there are those in the Republican Party who may want somebody else, they're quickly running out of time and options, I think, to stop Donald Trump. But we're seeing the full display of the divisions, the fissures in the Republican Party on display. And that's going to continue through the nominating convention.
What about Rubio calling it quits? How will that affect the whole contest?
Ted Cruz is asking Rubio supporters to get behind him, putting out the welcome mat. It's not clear right now who his supporters might go to. There's a story of someone who still has a bright future. He just didn't click in this electoral season. The big reason probably is two words, Donald and Trump.
So, and over on the Democratic side, is Clinton unstoppable?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton had a better night even than Donald Trump had, and that's saying something. By winning not only Florida, but by winning the state of Ohio, both of those are key swing states in our elections, by the way, in the presidential elections, I think Clinton now has a stranglehold on the nomination. The math doesn't work for Bernie Sanders. He would have to win all the remaining contests by more than 60%, because in the Democratic rules, they award it proportionally. You don't have winner-take-all contests. So Bernie Sanders is going to move on, he says. He's going to keep going. But they have to start asking some serious questions. Does prolonging the Democratic fight hurt Clinton's chances of winning in November? I think you're going to hear more Democrats start to talk along those lines.
What about if there's some rumors about Clinton taking Bernie Sanders on as a vice president?
I don't know. I mean, I've heard some people wonder about that, but I think she'll probably look in a different direction. But what she will be interested in taking on is the Sanders message. That's clearly resonated, particularly with younger voters. And this has been a real weak point for Hillary Clinton, something she's going to need to work on, and independent voters, both key constituencies in the general
and
election.
And that one-sentence message is?
Basically, we need to share the wealth in this country, take from the billionaire class, and the struggling middle class needs to get more of a share of that.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jim, for your insight. Always appreciate it.
You bet.
And over here is our social media reporter, Andrew Palchewski, who's going to talk to us about all the reports about this on the web.
Yeah, lots of talk on social media about last night's votes. As we talked about this morning on International Edition, hashtag Goodbye Rubio Tuesday. It's kind of a take on the Rolling Stones song, Goodbye Ruby Tuesday. A lot of people using that hashtag last night. But as Jim alluded to, maybe a bright future for Marco Rubio. A lot of people saying that after last night's concession speech, he'll be a great front runner for 2020 or 2024, and he's very young yet. So a lot of people even looking forward to the next election or the election after that saying, well, he's still got a shot. Otherwise, the candidates' supporters are, as always after these contests, kind of digging in their heels. Bernie Sanders supporters saying they're going to press on. Something that I saw recently, someone said that campaigns don't end for a lack of ideas, they end for a lack of money. And Bernie Sanders certainly is raising a lot of money from small donors, so that his supporters are pointing that out on social media, saying that we're going to press on because we've got the money to do so. We're going to keep taking our ideas out there. And of course, Donald Trump, the juggernaut that he is on the Republican side, pushing forward, his supporters are always very vocal on social media, as is he for that matter. So he's being very kind of bombastic and saying, well, I'm the front runner. I've won all these things. Yet again, I've won these contests.
And we have another really big story today, and that's about the Supreme Court nominee from President Obama.
Yes, and we're going to hear a little bit about
just
that
in a moment or
just
two.
Moments from now. But the name is Merrick Garland.
Yep.
He is the chief judge on the D.C. Court of Appeals. Very surprising because a lot of people thought it was going to be Sri Srinivasan, who was a judge that would have been the first Asian American on the Supreme Court. And it was interesting tracking the trends. You saw this morning the name Sri Srinivasan kind of trending upwards on Twitter, and you can see a graph of it, you know, people using that more and more until it hits a point when the name Merrick Garland came out, and you see Sri Srinivasan's name drop and Merrick Garland's name skyrockets. So you can actually track, it's very interesting, track through these Twitter analytics and these trends the moment when that name leaked out and when we got the news.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Black holes aren't usually visible since material surrounding them, even light, is devoured by their intense gravity. But occasionally, a black hole can draw in material, such as a star, so rapidly that it spits some of it out, producing a powerfully bright light in the process. Last June, astronomers noticed that a black hole called V404 Cygni, some 7,800 light years from Earth, became very bright for about a two-week period. As they observed the phenomena, they noticed the black hole also produced very bright flashes of red light that lasted only fractions of a second. The astronomers say that each of these flashes produced light so intense that it had the equivalent power of about 1,000 suns. Poshak Gandhi, lead author of a study detailing the astronomers' discovery, says that the red flashes seem to have been produced when the black hole was at the peak of its feeding frenzy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
U.S. President Barack Obama has named a nominee to replace the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia.
Today I am nominating Chief Judge Merrick Brian Garland to join the Supreme Court.
It's called VOA Now. Correspondent Catherine Gibson is at the White House and joins us on the line. Hi there, Catherine.
Hi, Susan.
Hi. What can you tell us about this nominee, Merrick Garland?
Well, you know, a lot of people are saying that Garland is the safe choice, but President Obama is really looking at this as a way to rise above the petty politics of this moment, and that's what he said, and really give a choice that is unimpeachable in terms of his background and qualifications and personality. And he certainly hopes that he'll be able to push that nominee through the Senate.
Well, who is Merrick Garland? What do we know about him?
We know that he actually left a lucrative law practice to go back into public service. We know that he has a personal interest in mentoring youth here in the D.C. area, and he's dealt with a lot of national security cases while he's been on the D.C. circuit. So he certainly has the experience and the personal background to serve as a Supreme Court nominee. We'll see if he gets through and serves on the court.
Do we know if he has any personal relationship with the president?
He didn't mention that in the Rose Garden ceremony. He did mention that he was honored to be nominated by a fellow Chicagoan. So that was a moment of levity in the Rose Garden when he said that. And he was very emotional, too, speaking about the history of his family coming to this country and the values of hard work and character that they had instilled in him.
Some members of the U.S. Senate who have to confirm the president's choice are saying that they're not going to consider anyone until after the next presidential election. What is the feeling about all that at the White House?
Well, I think with this nomination today, the president was hoping that he could put forward a nominee that would be very difficult for Senate Republicans to object to. Someone who's already been through the confirmation process, who's respected on both sides of the aisle, and who doesn't really have much in his background so far that I'm hearing about that can be pointed at to as a reason to deny his nomination. So I think the president took a very safe choice in terms of getting that nomination through.
Why didn't you choose some of the other nominees? Did they let you know that?
You know, we're not hearing about that right now at the White House. What we are hearing is that Garland is the nominee who is respected on both sides of the aisle. And that spirit of bipartisanship is really something I think the president is hoping to summon as we move forward in this very difficult process.
Well, you know, it's quite an honor for a president to name a Supreme Court justice. Not every president gets the opportunity. It's not something that they are automatically allowed to do. It's a chance thing.
Right, right.
So was the feeling there at the White House today sort of a joyous one rather than one a little worried about what the Senate will do?
You know, it was a beautiful day. It was a beautiful ceremony in the Rose Garden. People looking around, people seemed very happy. I think they felt very safe with this choice, that it's the best choice moving forward. But everybody acknowledges that this is going to be a very difficult process, particularly in the, you know, political climate that we're experiencing right now in the United States. You really can't predict anything and what even the Republican presidential candidates might say about the choice. I'm sure they'll have plenty to say in the coming days.
And somebody was saying on the Senate side of Congress that the new nominee, whether it be Clinton or Trump or any of the other candidates, they may very well pick Merrick Garland themselves.
Oh, absolutely. That's reading through Twitter and the social media reaction just before the announcement. Everyone was saying this is definitely something that Clinton would have done. And, you know, that makes it a good choice.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Catherine. I appreciate you speaking with us from the White House.
You're so welcome. Have a good day, Susan.
You too. Thanks a lot. Talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye-bye.
All right, talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye. Coming up on International Edition, a harsh sentence for an American in North Korea and a virtual time machine. North Korea has sentenced an American university student to 15 years hard labor for subversion after he publicly confessed to trying to steal a propaganda banner from a hotel. 21-year-old University of Virginia student Otto Warmber, under arrest since January, was convicted and sentenced today in a one-hour trial before North Korea's Supreme Court. According to the New York Times, former New Mexico governor and veteran diplomat Bill Richardson met Tuesday with two North Korean UN diplomats to press for Warmber's release. Richardson said the diplomats promised him they would convey the request. Richardson has been involved in gaining the freedom of other detained Americans in North Korea. The sentence comes at a time of heightened tensions over tough new UN sanctions following the North's latest nuclear test in January and a rocket launch in February, both banned activities under previous sanctions. Go Myung-hyun, a research fellow at the Seoul-based ASEAN Institute for Policy Studies, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he was not surprised at the harsh sentence given Pyongyang's penchant for hostage diplomacy.
There are precedents to this kind of hostage diplomacy conducted by North Korea. If you remember, former President Carter and former President Clinton had to visit North Korea to rescue American citizens who were being held in North Korea against their will. So I think it's a repeat of the same pattern we have seen before.
Do you think the North, by taking this action, is expecting some senior American official to come to North Korea pleading for his release?
That's correct. That's the only way North Korea can bring a senior American official to North Korea. So what really matters here is not about the content or substance for what's really going on. It's not really about actually releasing an American hostage here. It's about the appearance of a senior American official visiting North Korea and maybe even actually meeting, depending on the status and the level of the senior American official, right? But then what matters to the North Korean regime is holding meeting, appearance of having meeting with a senior American official to be used as probably as a domestic propaganda.
And you think this senior American official, whoever it may turn out to be, North Korea wants to speak with that person about current tensions?
North Korea will try to, but I don't think that they really care about that much because they understand that there are other communication channels to hold discussions about the current tensions in the Korean Peninsula besides having a face-to-face meeting in Pyongyang. For instance, they can just email a State Department official if they want to have a meeting to have a discussion about substantial issues about the Korean Peninsula. So there's a need for that. That's the reason why I believe North Koreans are going to use this occasion as a way to showcase how North Korean regime is capable of calling in any senior level of North American official to Pyongyang.
The New York Times reports that former Governor Bill Richardson, who was an envoy at one time to North Korea, met with the North's ambassador to the UN on Tuesday to press for the release of this young man. Mm-hmm. He said he urged the humanitarian release of Otto Warmbier, and they agreed to convey the request. Do you think Mr. Richardson might be a likely candidate to come to North Korea?
Yeah, he's been to North Korea several times for the same mission. But then what I'm afraid of is that North Korea might be looking for a fresh face in this occasion. Maybe even like a higher-ranking official.
And Go Myung-hyun says, given past experience, he does not expect Warmbier to serve out his full 15 years. He suggests the matter may be resolved soon after the North Korean Communist Party Congress in May. In the meantime, he says, he doubts Warmbier will experience the kind of harsh incarceration reserved for North Koreans. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Autism spectrum disorder is seen across the globe. It's 5 times more common in boys, and the diagnosis is usually made at about age 4. Genevieve Zapula realized there was something different about her son Henry early on.
He just didn't have that same level of interaction.
Researchers from Australia's La Trobe University in Melbourne have created an app to help parents who suspect their child may have autism.
We know that early intervention can actually improve children's developmental outcomes.
Dr. Josephine Barbaro says that the autism app called AS Detect takes parents through a series of steps to help identify whether their child as young as 12 months may have autism. Genevieve Sapula's son Henry was diagnosed with autism at age 2.
By the time he goes to school, that he will be at that stage where he won't be having those issues with settling and social interaction.
I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
If you've ever wanted to see what life was like in another time, a new virtual reality app lets you do just that. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the Time Looper app is taking people back in time at several historic sites.
If you visit the Tower of London, you will see the building with the moat drained. But if you use a new Time Looper app, the modern city melts away and you're in 1255 London. What are now city streets are fields, and the tower is surrounded by water, all by using your smartphone and a simple cardboard viewer. Andrew Feinberg is the co-founder of Time Looper, which uses virtual reality technology on your smartphone to transport you to another time.
We actually overlay the current infrastructure with what the infrastructure of the tower and the surrounding environment was like in 13th century London. So for example, now you see a Starbucks, and now you see the tower as it looks today with the moat drain. When we take you back in time, you actually see the historically accurate representation of the tower in its heyday.
Feinberg and his co-founder, Yit Yitter, first do historical research on the sites. Then they record the modern site in 360-degree virtual reality video. Then, using a green screen and costumed actors, they recreate the site as it was in an earlier time. After some 3D modeling and some visual effects, suddenly Trafalgar Square in London is not in 2016, but in 1940 during the Nazi Blitzkrieg. Swarms of German bombers appear in the sky, and one actually drops a bomb near Nelson's Column, an iconic landmark in London. Yit Yitter says the technology enhances the experience for people who might see the modern view but have no idea what happened there.
Nothing replaces the experience of being on site, but you don't always know what the stories are about those sites. So the first thing is experience those destinations, Colosseum, even without going there and getting more excited about that destination. And then the second thing is when you arrive, learning more about those stories.
Time Looper is a boon for the tourist industry, allowing visitors to see the Great Fire of London or the Thames River's Tower Bridge before it was a bridge. Ruth Poling is a Blue Badge tourist guide in London.
I think it's just really, really immersive. I mean, my job is a storyteller. I'm here to conjure up what things are like. And this just gives me something else I can use, particularly with small children, getting them really engaged in the story that I'm telling.
Chris Early, the head of Tower Bridge, says Time Looper helps people understand the impact of historical events.
You might be able to experience the looking at the Great Fire from stood at home, but when you're actually up here in the walkways, you get a sense of where it all happened. And of course, the second that the experience finished, you're looking at exactly the same view, but in the modern day. So it gives it a lot more context.
Time Looper plans to launch in New York City in April. There, visitors will be able to see Times Square on VJ Day in August of 1945. They'll also get to see workers eating lunch atop a skyscraper during construction of Rockefeller Center in 1932. Following their launch last year, Feinberg and Yitter have been busy doing deals with other locations, from China to Spain. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thanks for joining us today for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Gulf Cooperation Council recently designated Lebanon-based, Iran-supported Hezbollah as a terrorist group. The GCC is a regional coalition composed of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Oman, Kuwait, and Bahrain. Formally designating Hezbollah follows similar moves to designate Hezbollah and/or its military wing by a variety of countries and organizations in the past, including the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, Israel, Australia, New Zealand, and the European Union. GCC Secretary General Abdullatif bin Rashid al-Zayani said the new designation was due to hostile acts carried out by Hezbollah militia fighters in Syria, Yemen, and Iraq that included recruiting youths of GCC countries to carry out terrorist acts, smuggling of arms and explosives, inciting sedition, and provoking chaos and violence in a blatant violation of the GCC state's sovereignty, security, and independence. At a press briefing, State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner said the United States welcomes the designation by the GCC.
And we're going to continue to discuss with the GCC countries, all of the countries, frankly, on how law enforcement, sanctions, and other tools can be used to crack down on Hezbollah's ongoing terrorist operations and activities in the region.
The United States designated Hezbollah a foreign terrorist organization in 1997 and has condemned its numerous acts of and plans for terror around the world, including in places as far-flung as Bulgaria, Thailand, and Cyprus, as well as in the Middle East, against, among others, Israelis, Iraqis, and Syrians opposed to the brutal regime of Bashar al-Assad. The U.S. has sanctioned Hezbollah military leaders, procurement facilitators, and businesses with close ties to the organization. The GCC's formal designation of Hezbollah as a terrorist group is further evidence that, as Secretary of State John Kerry has noted, a growing number of governments are recognizing Hezbollah as the dangerous and destabilizing terrorist organization that it is. The United States will continue to take steps to rein in Hezbollah's terrorist and criminal activities and encourages all countries to do the same.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.